This hearing of the Senate's Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Today is Thursday, April 9th. The time is 3:30 p.m. We are in Butrovich Room 205. Members present are Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, Vice Chair Giesel, myself, Chair Dunbar. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I would like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Kyla Tupo from the Juno LAO for staffing the committee today. Today's agenda, we have one item on our agenda today. We will be having a second hearing on SB 281, Healthcare Compact's Rural Health Program. This bill is sponsored by the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. During today's meeting, we'll hear invited testimony from the Department of Health and Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing, as well as the Department of Health. Yeah. Let the record reflect, I've also been joined by Senator Tobin. I also intend to open public testimony today. We will begin with testimony from Ms. Sylvan Robb, the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, if she can come forward. I also want to note for the committee, I have a CS that is on your desk, or has been emailed to you, rather. Apologies. We're not going to move to adopt the CS today. It does make some pretty substantive changes. Most significantly, it removes the PA scope of practice portion, and it makes changes based on feedback from the Department of Health to the RHTP sort of legislative oversight provisions that are pretty significant. So we will bring that up at a later date. Today, we're going to start with, again, Director Robb, who will be talking about some of the compacts in more detail. So, Director Robb, thank you for being with us today. If you could put yourself on the record, and please begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Dunbar and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, I'm Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Thank you for the opportunity to present this afternoon to offer input on the compacts from a licensing perspective. Since the chair mentioned at the last meeting on this bill that the committee is reasonably familiar with compacts and you had an overview of each of the compacts at the previous hearing, I wanted to clarify some of the details of the compacts in response to concerns you expressed. My comments will be directed to the three compacts within this bill that would be administered by the Department of Commerce, the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, also known as the IMLC, the Physician Assistant Licensure Compact, or PA Compact, and the Interjurisdictional Psychology Compact, or SIPAC. EMS licensure and hence the compact are administered by the Department of Health. We agree that all of these compacts are important and will benefit the state, the relevant professionals, and the Alaskans they care for. However, I would be remiss to not briefly mention the fifth of the five compacts we must join to keep the full $272 million awarded under the Rural Health Transformation Program, which is the Nurse Licensure Compact, or NLC. From a licensing standpoint, and based on feedback from nurses, as well as vacancy rates in the state, the Nurse Licensure Compact is the most important of the compacts for us to pass, which is why it's our department's top priority. And we hope the legislature will pass the NLC legislation as well. With that said, I do recognize that the Nurse Compact is not part of SB 281, so the rest of my presentation will remain focused on the compacts at hand. Moving on to slide two, first let's talk about the cost to the state and the impact on licensing fees. And let me say I really appreciate the concerns the committee has raised about the potential impacts to licensing fees. The division is also always concerned about keeping licensing fees low. Just to provide a quick refresher, with input from the relevant board, licensing fees are set by the division at the rate necessary to cover the regulatory costs for that occupation. In an effort to keep fees as low as possible, the division constantly looks for efficiencies. Joining compacts does just that because it reduces redundant verifications of professionals' credentials that were already completed by another state, therefore reducing workload, which reduces the administrative and therefore regulatory costs to a program. While some compacts may also see a corresponding reduction in revenue because of reduction in Alaska licenses, we are confident that the reduced workload will outpace the decrease in revenue. All of this translates to either no impact on fees or, in some cases, even a reduction in fees depending on the profession. for the Physical Therapy Compact, which went live in Alaska last year, the licensing examiner that used to spend 100% of her time on the physical and occupational therapy licensing program now splits her time between that and another program. Since our staff carefully code their time to reflect the program they are working on, this resulted in savings for that program and ultimately lower licensing costs. So now to address the costs to the state for each of these three compacts. Starting with the IMLC, there is no cost to the state to join. We anticipate either no impact on licensing fees or an eventual reduction in licensing fees, since the IMLC compact structure requires those being licensed through the compact to obtain an Alaska license and pay the standard fee. While the PA compact was enacted when the seventh state passed the legislation to join the compact, and just as a reminder, there are 20 states that are currently part of the compact, it is still being stood up and therefore is not yet operational. So the cost to the state hasn't yet been determined by the compact commission. And another reminder, that compact commission is comprised of one member from each of the member states. If Alaska joins before the Compact Commission becomes operational, then we will have a seat at the table and a voice in determining if there should be a cost to each participating state and what that cost could be. Many compacts do not charge states for membership, since the member states themselves are the ones determining if there will be a fee. And the highest annual assessment fee that exists right now is $6,000, which is significantly less than the cost of even one licensing examiner position. SIPAC does charge the state $10 for each applicant for a telepsychology privilege or the authorization to temporarily practice in person in another state for licensees who list Alaska as their home state. However, the maximum any state can be charged in a calendar year is $6,000. The cost to regulate Alaska's psychology licensing program last year was $260,000. So the cost of the compact would be a small fraction of the annual program costs. Here on slide three, let's talk about the cost for licensees.
I'm sorry, Director Ron, can I pause you for a second? We have a question from Senator Klayman.
It's probably either one of the slides. The physician assistant compact is not operational. And does that mean we join the compact, but until it actually gets organized and moving, nothing happens?
Through the chair to Senator Klayman, nothing happens in terms of individuals being able to practice in another state. The PA compact, it was seven states that needed to enact the legislation. Once that happened, then they started working on all the things that need to happen in order to make the compact operational. The largest one of those things is typically, and the most time-consuming, is creating that licensure database to ensure that all of the states are able to share information about the individuals who are practicing under the compact and any discipline-related information that needs to be shared. And so getting that stood up and having the states connect can take a little bit of time. So until that happens, you are correct that nobody can get a compact privilege or practice in another state.
And what's the current status of it becoming operational? I guess how many states have joined so far? And it sounds like even when they get seven, there's going to be some time before they're operational.
Through the chair to Senator Klayman. So the compact is enacted because it requires seven states in order for it to be enacted. And so sort of once they got that seventh state, it came to life, so to speak. There are 20 states who have passed the legislation and are members of the compact. And so I believe that they anticipate the compact going live sometime in 2027.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Robb, you might not be the one to answer this, but if the compact doesn't go operational by the time the determination about whether we've met the stipulations underneath our application, which I think is December 31st, 2027, will we lose points or how would that be evaluated by the federal government?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, knowing that there is a whole row of individuals from the Department of Health here, I would defer questions on how CMS might respond to that to them. And Mr. Chair, I don't know if you'd like an answer now, or I know they're.
I think
to be
we can
later.
Wait until. Thank you, Senator Tobin. I think we can wait until they are up to present. I'll note also for the record on and for my colleagues online, we have Lisa Purinton from the Department of Public Safety, the Commissioner Heidi Hedberg of the Department of Health, Brian Webb. And Brian Webb, State EMS Training Department of Health, also available for questions. And we have a very significant team from the Department of Health here as well, who will testify shortly. Please continue, Director Robb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on slide 3, let's talk about the cost to licensees. So as a reminder, joining the compacts just creates another pathway to licensure. No one is obligated to participate in the compact unless they want to do so. Alaska licensure, allowing practice only in Alaska, will always be an option for anyone interested and qualified. So starting with the IMLC, which just as a reminder is an expedited licensure model where a physician who meets the standards in the compact then obtains a letter of verification from their state of primary residence that they can then use to expedite licensure in other states. The initial cost to a physician to participate in the compact is $700 plus the standard cost of a license in any compact state where they wish to practice. Again, we don't know what the cost to licensees will be for the PA compact since it's not yet operational, but we would like to have a say in that by having a seat on the compact commission by having joined the compact. However, the PA compact operates on the same privilege to practice structure as the physical therapy compact, which again went live last year. So if it operates in the same way, the practitioner will pay a fee to the compact plus a fee set by the participating state that they're applying for the privilege to practice, for both the initial compact privilege and then for any renewal of that privilege. SIPAC does charge psychologists who wish to practice under the compact and who meet the standards of the compact. As a reminder, this compact offers 2 interjurisdictional practice authorizations, one via telehealth and another for an up to 30-day temporary in-person authorization. They have a lot of names for things, so bear with me. So the cost for the telehealth authority is $400 initially, and that get somebody an e-passport, which they obtain from the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards, which then allows them to obtain an authority to practice interjurisdictional telepsychology, the APIT, from the compact for $40. That then allows them to practice telepsychology in member states. It's $100 to renew that e-passport annually and $40 annually to renew the APIT. Then for the Interjurisdictional Practice Certificate, the IPC, which again they obtain from the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards, that allows them, that's $200. They would then get the temporary authorization to practice from the compact for $40. And that again allows them to practice temporarily in person for 30 days in other jurisdictions that are members. It's $50 annually to renew the IPC and $40 annually to renew that temporary authorization to practice. Here on slide 4, let's address the claim that compacts have a negative impact on our ability to know who's practicing in Alaska. A common misconception is that our division or its boards have information on a licensee's state of primary residence, physical location, employer, or if they're even practicing. The reality is that we don't have any of this information for any of the professions impacted by the compacts within SB 281, or actually any of the other compact bills currently before the legislature. An Alaska license simply authorizes a qualified professional to practice here if they want to, but we have no idea if, when, or where they actually practice. Under the compacts, as is the case now, the division will know who can legally practice here, but we won't know who is. And just like now, there are online databases that will allow us to see who is authorized to practice in our state. So for physicians and osteopathic doctors, anyone can use our division's online professional license search to identify those actively licensed practitioners, just like you can now. For the PA compact, this is going to get a little repetitive, but since it's not operational, it's not entirely clear how that will work. But most compacts with this practice to privilege model, like the PA compact, have an online directory, plus the ability for us to show those with Alaska compact privileges in the division's online professional license search. That's the way the currently operational physical therapy compact works. And finally, PsychPAC has an online verification directory that shows which psychologists have credentials through the compact. It does not show which specific states they are practicing in because that's not something the practitioner is required to specify. If we join the compact, we will add a link to PsychPAC's online directory verification on our professional license search page. Here on slide five, I wanted to address the issue of cultural competency. It came up briefly at the last hearing, but we've heard claims that practitioners who obtain a licensure through compacts won't have the same cultural training or awareness as current Alaska licensees. This is based on a misconception that Alaska currently requires cultural training or education for initial licensure. The reality is that Alaska does not require any cultural competency credential to obtain a medical, physician assistant, psychology, or nursing license. So allowing individuals to obtain licensure through a compact rather than through Alaska licensure will have no impact on that practitioner's cultural awareness. If there are any such requirements for practitioners now, it's at the employer's discretion and not a requirement for licensure. On slide six, let's talk about disciplinary authority and investigations. So there's no compact under the legislature's consideration that would result in Alaska giving up any sovereignty because the relevant Alaska boards retain the right to investigate and discipline a practitioner providing care or services to a patient or client located in Alaska. And that is up to revoking the practitioner's right to practice in Alaska. And that's regardless of which compact they use to obtain that practice privilege or where their home state is. This means that we'll have the same disciplinary authority we currently hold. It's just called action against their multi-state privilege or interjurisdictional authorization, of course, depending on which compact we're talking about. Rather than discipline against their Alaska license. But I want to stress that the outcome is the same. The result is that they are no longer legally able to practice in Alaska. If we do take license or privilege action, we'd immediately report that to the appropriate compact shared database system administrator, who then ensures the home state is aware, and all the other states would be able to see that as well, helping improve public safety across state lines. Each of the compacts require the relevant board to apply Alaska statutes and regulations to determine the appropriate disciplinary action. Those laws remain fully under the legislature and the board's authority. The compact has no jurisdiction over Alaska's practice laws, scope of practice, or due process requirements. The bottom line is that our boards will retain full authority over the relevant professional practice in Alaska and over who can practice here. And as a reminder, if a professional loses their eligibility for an expedited license, practice privilege, or interjurisdictional authorization, whether it was issued by Alaska or another state, they can still opt to apply for a single state Alaska license through our standard process. Here on slide seven, we wanted to discuss the impact on the number of providers in Alaska. We have limited data specific to Alaska of the impacts on the number of providers because we only have one compact that is live for Alaska, and that's only been live for a year, and of course that's the physical therapy compact. However, the data that we do have from the physical therapy compact is encouraging. Under the physical therapy compact, we've seen 127 physical therapists and 15 physical therapy assistants obtain privileges to practice in Alaska through the compact, whereas only 24 of the Alaska licensed physical therapists and 6 of Alaska's physical therapy assistants have obtained privileges to practice in other states. This means the compact so far has potentially brought in 5 times more practitioners than may have left. Although, again, I do want to stress that we do not know where or if people are practicing. We also reviewed the research mentioned at the previous hearing by Carl Sims, who was with the Council of State Governments National Center for Interstate Compacts, which showed that following the adoption of the IMLC for physicians, states saw a 3% increase in new out-of-state physician practices. I do want to note that data is from 2017 and 2018. They did see a decrease in 2019 and 20, likely due to COVID, and the study did not have more recent data. So full transparency.
We have a question from Senator Klayman.
When you say out-of-state practice, just describe what you mean by that. Does that mean a physician that's licensed in Alaska practicing somewhere else, or somebody from out of state practicing in Alaska? The numbers, flesh that out in more detail on that number.
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Klayman, my reading on that and having looked at the study is that would be Alaska physicians who are opting to open a practice in another state.
That's the opposite. Do you have a follow-up?
And so it shows that we had an increase of Alaska physicians going to practice in other states?
That was my understanding. And then there are a couple more bullets. So that study also found that states participating in the IMLC saw nearly double the practice growth of non-participating states. And so I think Senator Klayman, that is going both directions. So there's just, it allows freedom of movement and physicians to be able to practice in many different states, obviously more easily, which is the point of the compact.
So I have a follow-up on that, then actually two questions. So that second bullet is interesting. It's sort of a correlation causation thing, right? So states that were participating had twice the practice growth, but I don't believe, unless you have the data suggests otherwise, it compared the states before and after the practice growth. That is to say, the way that statement reads, it's saying Texas has, twice the practice growth, let's say, of Arkansas, and then Texas joins the compact, but they already had twice the growth. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it would be attributed to IMLC. But unless they did a time series and they said, it had this level and then they joined and it jumped, right? That's not what the second bullet is asserting, right? That is to say, it's not a time series where they're saying that they had twice the practice growth after as they did before.
Mr. Chair, I would have to refresh my memory of the methodology of that study, but I do take your point. I mean, correlation is not causation, and so we would need to look at the relative time periods. And I don't recall if the methodology was set up the way you're describing.
The on the prior set of data there about the PT compact. So first of all, is the audiologist compact not operational? We did join it, correct? Do we not have data from that one?
Mr. Chair, so when we joined the audiology speech language pathology compact in 2024, it was in the same phase as the PA compact is now, where it was enacted, but it was not operational. It has subsequently become operational, and so we are actively working with their IT folks right now on getting those data connections that I mentioned that are so important to ensure the safety of Alaskans, to make sure that we have access to see all of that information about who's practicing and get immediate access to any disciplinary information.
Very good. And the follow-up on the PT data that you have, I believe your prior slides indicate that you don't track where they live, that is to say, out-of-state folks have asked for privileges to practice in Alaska. Alaskans have asked to participate out-of-state. But do we know, and maybe it's too soon to know, have any of those Alaskans subsequently moved out of the state? That is to say, perhaps we have more people licensed now in Alaska, but fewer people actually living in Alaska. That is, they join the multi-state compact, it's easy to go back and forth, and now they live in Oregon. you know, and, you know, there's pluses and minuses to that, mm-hmm. right? We want more providers in Alaska. At the same time, we also want people to live in Alaska, mm-hmm. right? So is there any data on that second point?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. So with the compacts that are structured like the PA compact and the physical therapy compact, with that privilege to practice or practice privilege model where you know, apply through the compact and say, I have a Colorado home license, I would like to go practice in Utah. And then if you subsequently decide, I would also like to go practice in Arizona, you have to apply for that practice privilege in each of those states. You can only obtain your license needs to be from your home state. And so for the data on the physical therapist, in order to be compact eligible, those individuals do need to be Alaska residents. So while typically we do not know where people live, we do know that for people who have obtained that practice privilege, they have to live here.
So in this case, it's 30 individuals, correct? 24 plus six. Do we have any time series of maybe we only have 1 year of data now, so we're not sure, 2 years, but, you know, are we gaining or losing PTs physically living in Alaska?
Mr. Chair, again, that's not information that we have. So for the individuals who opt to get a compact privilege in another state, they have to be an Alaska resident, but for anyone else who has a physical therapist license or a physical therapy assistant license, you just have to meet the qualifications for Alaska licensure. So there's no requirement that you live here. So that's not data that we have.
Very good. Senator Myers.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was just wondering if, excuse me, the study we referenced regarding the IMLC, I was wondering if we could get that provided to the committee.
Do you have that? Director Robb?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. We'd be happy to provide that. And I don't know. I believe Mr. Sims had offered to send it as well, but we're happy to resend it to the committee.
Very good. I don't see any other questions on this slide. If you'd like to, I think that is your last slide. Are there any? Oh, go ahead, Director Robb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just before we wrap up, I would like to note that in the licensing world, joining compacts is becoming more common and in some cases inevitable. So 22 states are in 10 or more professional licensing compacts. And there will be some compacts that are not a good fit for Alaska. For instance, if any of the agreed upon standards in a compact were not equal to or higher than Alaska's, that would not be a compact that we would be interested in seeing Alaska join. However, I can say with certainty that this is not the case for any of the five compacts Alaska has agreed to join as part of our Rural Health Transformation Award. Compacts are the primary topic of conversation at most professional national conferences these days, and that's why we're seeing so many professional licensure compact bills in front of the legislature this year. I believe I counted more than 10. Given that for the IMLC and SciPact, 44 and 43 states respectively are members, and 20 states have already joined the PA compact. I believe Alaska is likely to join all five of the Rural Health Transformation Compacts eventually. It's a when, not an if. And so our hope is that if we join now, we can retain the entire $272 million for our state versus joining later after we've lost some of those funds. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I want to sincerely thank the committee for the opportunity to provide a licensing perspective on these compacts, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions there may be.
Thank you, Director Robb. I don't see any questions. Thank you very much for your presentation. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up the next presenter. back on the record. Next, we will hear from the Department of Health. With us today, we have, Emily Ricci, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health, Betsy Wood, Director of the Office of Health Savings, and then online we have Commissioner Heidi Hedberg, also the Department of Health. I believe that Deputy Commissioner Ricci will be sort of driving the bus today. So if you'd like to put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and today we wanted to provide the committee with just a brief overview and update of some of the new steps that have occurred within the Rural Health Transformation Program. And I wanted to start with talking a little bit about the Advisory Council, also because we know that that relates to SB 281. So the Advisory Council, the Department established an Advisory Council made up of two bodies. The first is a steering committee, and the second is a kind of stakeholder committee. And the steering committee has several individuals on it, including Senator Giesel. And that steering committee is really tasked with providing, acting in an advisory council to the department at a kind of high level and directional setting. And this is something that I think we had envisioned in our application. We want to make sure the department really wants to make sure that we are providing a space to have meaningful discussion about the direction of the Rural Health Transformation Program, including how are projects, what is the framework for in which projects are evaluated? How can we develop a consistent forum where we can communicate some of the topics, whether it's policy topics or direction that the state needs to undertake as it works through implementing and operating this program over the next 5 years? The purpose of the Advisory Council is to provide structured, informed, and directional recommendations to the commissioner, and to do that in an open setting that the public can attend and can listen to. The kind of the main advisory body of the committee is the steering committee, and that is made up of 7 members. Those include the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Alaska Municipal League, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, the Alaska Primary Care Association, a representative from the State Senate, which is currently Senator Giesel, and a representative from the House of Representatives, which is Representative Mina. And we are very grateful for everyone that is participating on this advisory council. The stakeholder committee is intended to provide a more robust body with many more voices to provide feedback as well to the steering committee for consideration and direction to the department. As designed right now, the stakeholder committee has up to 18 seats, and we envision them meeting probably biannually. We've envisioned the steering committee, which is that smaller group, to meet at least quarterly, but more frequently as needed. And right now, particularly, we're finding that more frequent meetings are necessary. The 18 seats include a variety of representatives from, the Behavioral Health Association to the Alaska Association of Developmental Disabilities, individuals from a senior association, healthcare providers, tribal health organizations, and social services organizations. The department anticipates having the first meeting of the steering committee or the stakeholder committee, that larger group, in June, and we will be issuing a request for nominations for those seats probably within the next 4 to 6 weeks. Moving back to that smaller committee, the steering committee, the steering committee actually had its first meeting just a few weeks ago. And again, we appreciate the members who are willing to serve and participate in that steering committee. Currently, the deputy commissioner position, which is my position, acts as a non-voting chair of the steering committee in order to kind of guide the conversation and run the committee. In the first session, we introduced the members of the steering committee effectively to the public and really kicked off diving into work, looking at the evaluation framework for the process that the department will be using to award funding for the Rural Health Transformation Program. And we've talked about that process with this committee in the past, but there's really kind of two stages. And the initial stage of the process is something called a letter of interest. And it is an opportunity for eligible entities to put forward kind of high-level information about their project that can be used to assess where their project is at in terms of its ability to be ready to receive funding, to receive assistance for planning, or to actually move forward as a project that is ready for implementation. Given the tight time frame we are on with the Rural Health Transformation Program and the need to effectively use funds, it's very, very important that we make sure projects are ready if they are being funded. That letter of interest period opened in February and closed. We are currently in the process of kind of evaluating those letters of interest right now. And the letters of interest, those that are evaluated as being ready for funding for readiness or planning, we anticipate announcing that probably in the next 3 to 4 weeks. We received more letters of interest, I think, than we anticipated. We received almost 1,800 letters of interest. And so the process has taken a little bit longer than we anticipated.
Question, Deputy Commissioner. For those that may missed the window but are interested in doing this, maybe for the next round of funding next year, when do you anticipate the window will be for them?
To the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. We anticipate the next round. We're potentially looking at opening those letters of interest in August.
Okay.
Yep.
And closing, any anticipated date of closing or August and then for the foreseeable future thereafter?
I think we are, to the chair, for the record, Emily Ricci, we are still working through what that schedule will look like. We know that, CMS is telling us that we will receive our award amount October 31st of every year. And we want to make sure that we are providing as much time as possible for entities to use the funding. So this year is a truncated year. It's a much shorter year than we would normally have, which is why this process is occurring in the spring. But typically, we anticipate the process would occur in the fall. So once we receive the award amount, we are ready to move forward expeditiously in allocating that award amount.
So CMS will give us a number every Halloween is the plan. Senator Tobin and then Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. So for these nearly 1,800 letters of interest, are these going to be made public so that folks know what projects have been proposed, or is there a process of where the public can see how these funds will be used or are proposed to be used?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, when the process is complete, we'll be posting that information, including, of course, the projects that were awarded, a description of the projects and the amount of the award, both for what we think about as kind of those readiness and planning grants, and then for those project implementation grants. I think we are still working through kind of what that dashboard will look like, because we want to make sure that as we enter into future years, we really, someone from the public can go and can use that dashboard in a thoughtful way to see how the projects complement each other, the areas of focus that are being built out, and how they tie back to the proposal initiatives, right? It's more than just a list of projects that are funded. It's really about how do they tie to the needs that we have in the state? How do those tie back to our proposal? And how can we see, you know, where are the projects based geographically? Where are they based for the size of the organization or the focus of the projects? So we envision and we want to build out a dashboard that allows people to look at that over multiple years.
Follow-up, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do you have an identified timeline for when this dashboard will be available for the public to view? Is it before the August date, or is it next year? Can you give us a little more information of when we can anticipate this information will be public?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin. We anticipate publishing and posting online the information about the awards, when they become public and available. I think as far as the building out the sophistication of the dashboard, I'm not sure when the timing of that will be. I think that's something that we will probably do through a contractor, and I think we're still evaluating kind of what that contract would look like and if there's other needs that we want to think about now for the rest of the project that would align with that.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, going back just a little bit, Deputy Commissioner, you mentioned that you are a non-voting member of the steering committee. I'm a little bit curious as to what exactly the steering committee is voting on, and then how binding are those votes on the decisions?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. That I am the only non-voting member on the steering committee. And really the intent is for the committee to make decisions for recommendations to the commissioner in consideration. So for example, we did not vote on this in the last advisory committee meeting, I think, because there was enough agreement overall that kind of the census and the discussion and the meeting minutes would be used as a basis for the recommendation. But we reviewed the evaluation framework for the projects that will move into the implementation phase. And that evaluation framework was posted online publicly so we could accept public comment, which is what we want to do every year. As we update these frameworks, right, as our projects develop and as we learn more, we anticipate that we need to be a little bit flexible in seeing what we may need to take into consideration and kind of adapt to that. So we put the evaluation framework out for public comment. We received those public comments. We shared those with the advisory committee. And then we had a discussion in that public setting with the advisory committee about the public comments, as well as any other recommendations or thoughts that advisory committee members had regarding the proposed evaluation framework. And so those are the types of discussions then that would move up to the commissioner, to the commissioner's office, and the rest of the Department of Health team as we update that evaluation framework and take that into consideration. There may be other decisions in the future that we have about focusing on specific areas to build out, or maybe financial considerations for how, you know, areas of focus that we might want to have from a budgetary perspective as we're thinking about how to allocate funding across the different implementation proposals. And we anticipate, you know, the steering committee would provide a recommendation, and if there's disagreement, they could vote on that recommendation, and that would be information available to the commissioner in designing and making decisions.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. As soon as I'm seeing the word voting, and I see it's in the bill as well, what's starting to come to mind is we've been warned multiple times by Ledge Legal that there's constitutional issues when you're talking about a body that has members on it appointed by both the executive and the legislative branch, and that's perfectly fine for an advisory body, but if there's something that's going to be binding, then that starts to raise constitutional issues. And so I'm just trying to see where the line is there on that.
Thank you, Senator Myers. My understanding is none of their votes are binding. This is all recommendations from the steering committee, correct? Okay.
To the chair, yes, that is correct. You know, another consideration too is conflict of interest. This will be a large award over many years, right, that we want to maintain. And we want to make sure that we are receiving the critical feedback from the individuals who are on the ground or who are representing providers that are working through this. So we want to make sure that we are preserving that feedback and getting that in a timely fashion. But we also want to make sure that we're not putting anyone on the advisory council in a position where they may have a conflict of interest. So in designing the roles and responsibility of the advisory council, we also spoke with CMS to make sure that as they looked at this, the directional advice that is provided through the advisory council protects the participating members on the council from that. So that's another important consideration.
Very good. I actually have a clarifying question off of Senator Tobin's. So when you talk about the dashboard, and so you're going to publicly post the proposals as they come in or afterwards, is that correct? You're going to show all the different LOIs that you received. Is that correct?
To the chair, Senator Dunbar, we can do that. I think typically in a state process, we usually post the proposals that have been awarded versus those that have been received. One thing that I think we want to make sure is that we're not doing any gotchas with anyone that submits a proposal. And so I would just want to go back and make sure we were clear with everyone submitting a letter of interest that we would post that publicly.
And then, the evaluation framework, is that going to have sort of a scoring criteria? You know, how explicit will it be scored, if that makes sense? Mm-hmm. And then if it is scored, who will get to see those scores? I mean, presumably the proposers would want to see it so they could, in the next round, improve their score by changing things. there would be utility for everyone to see everyone's scores. So they would have full transparency, and then they would understand, you know, this, they received this score here and we received a lower score. But I'm taking it to, taking your testimony to be that that is not the plan from the Department of Health. Is that correct?
To the chair, what we are working to balance is to make sure that we are identifying those applications that are strong, very strong, right, and can prioritize those when we think about the context of the grant and the funding and the opportunity. But we are also balancing that with ensuring that we have geographic diversity and representation, that we have representation across initiative types, right, and type of organization and size of organization and strategic initiatives. And it's hard to have a straight scoring mechanism that also allows for that flexibility and coherence for geographic diversity and some of the other issues that we know are critical to having this be successful in Alaska. What you wouldn't want to do is have a region where every, you know, in one region, all of the projects scored highly, and in other regions, maybe they did not score quite as highly, but they were really important and they weren't able to be funded because we weren't thinking about it from a multifaceted perspective. So the way that we've established the evaluation framework is there's two components. There's a framework that highlights, and there is a numerical value to these different elements, their alignment with the proposal initiative, right? Their ability to be sustainable, the feasibility of the project. How does that project impact the community or the members it's trying to serve, right? Is it thoughtful? So these questions are really designed to understand the strength of the proposal in relation to the application and to the communities and the proposed population that it's serving, right? So that's something that so that's one element. The other element is on top of that, we are layering on what we call a portfolio review, where we look at these kind of groupings of projects that have, again, risen to the top based on the strength of their scoring and the evaluation framework. And then we look at that across borough or census area. And we look at that with size of organization and with initiatives to try to make sure that we are getting that balance. And that review occurs within a department-led review committee that will also include individuals who are, you know, who do not have a conflict, that have subject matter expertise that can also join and participate in that review. And it's that combination of factors that are used to basically make a recommendation to the commissioner for the slate of projects that are funded.
That portfolio approach that weights things towards geographic diversity, does it take into account population and population density? Because RHTP says all of Alaska is rural, and I don't think they have a distinction between extreme rural and, you know, Anchorage rural.
Frontier.
Is that what they call it here?
Frontier is extreme rural.
Yes. Is that the term they use in the bill?
To the chair, I do not have the bill in front of me, but they do focus on the way we have described it in our application is rural, frontier, and remote communities. And part of that reflects how communities have identified themselves to us through the proposal development process.
So there won't be population weighting, or there will be?
To the chair, the way that what has been proposed, and again, this is online and part of what we talked about with the advisory committee, I'm looking at it right now, is it kind of describes project service area, and it has categories broken out by census area and borough. So we have everything from the Aleutians East Borough to Bristol Bay to Copper River to municipality, et cetera. So that's how we're looking at it. I don't know if Betsy, you'd like to add anything. Okay.
Senator Klayman.
Just for a little clarification, you're saying there's actually, even though we heard all of Alaska is rural for purposes of the federal bill, there's actually three categories you're looking at: geographically rural, frontier and remote? I'm just making sure I'm tracking.
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, we have not fully defined those terms anywhere in the application. And I think it's important to clarify that in the application, everywhere except Anchorage is considered rural. However, rural health transformation program funds can and are intended to be used throughout the state. And so that's a minor but kind of important distinction, because it is important to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, again, that those funds support rural populations. But we know that Alaskans move throughout the state. We know that we have a hub and spoke system, and we know that it's very important to have functional services in Anchorage that are serving rural areas as well.
Very good. Yeah, I'll just note that. You know, I grew up in rural areas. I appreciate that there is a strong focus on that geographic diversity and that we are trying to push services out to rural areas. At the same time, I wouldn't want things so skewed that it becomes, you know, if there are only four or five projects allowed in Anchorage or something like that, where we are systematically putting our thumb so much on the scale that Anchorage cannot benefit from this program in a meaningful way. And my understanding from testimony is that's not what was going to happen, that Anchorage also is going to be able to participate in this program.
That is true. That is correct.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. My first is still on this topic, as I'm looking at some of the documents that have been posted around the portfolio analysis framework and the project evaluation framework, but I don't see anything specific about the evaluation of the organization or the type of provider, about the health of that organization, about whether they have the resources or the capacity or the strength of the organization. I think a bit about the PPP program, where there were folks who just sprung up out of nowhere and took advantage of these dollars and then misused the public resources. So can you speak a little bit to the determination as you're looking at these LOIs about who is actually submitting these LOIs and what is the evaluation of that particular organization or that provider?
To the chair, Senator Tobin. So the LOIs gathered, I kind of think about it in steps, right? So the LOIs gathered kind of high-level information from a number of different organizations, because part of what we're also trying to balance is to make sure that we're not creating a process that is so difficult that smaller entities can't participate. So the letter of interest process was designed to create, to gather kind of high-level information from a number of different entities, and then using that information, you know, assess whether, again, their project idea is in a place where they can accept federal dollars, they're ready to accept federal dollars, because to your point, there may be many organizations that have a great idea, but they don't have what they need to be able to complete the federal reporting that we need, right? And we don't want to award money for a project that ends up creating issues down the road if they're not ready. Then looking at planning, and then for the proposal implementation, there will be another release in the next several weeks for entities that have demonstrated that they have the idea that is complete enough, the details, the timeline, the support, et cetera, to be mature enough to actually move into implementing that proposal. I think at that point, you will see much more detailed and specific information from those entities to help confirm and demonstrate that they have the organizational sophistication in order to utilize these funds effectively if they are awarded. So that's the next layer. That will be released, sometime in the next few weeks. Again, we're working with a slightly different timeline because of the volume that we received. But that is the next stage in the process where we can get significantly more, and we expect to get significantly more information from proposers before they are awarded funding.
A brief follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So here comes my follow-up to this question is, what I anticipate is there's going to be several hundred groups that don't fortunately get funded with this first round. And we here on the dais often get calls from folks who are frustrated or angry or they don't understand why. What is the appeals process? I understand the recommendation structure as you've described, but what happens if projects don't move forward and folks do want to appeal to the commissioner and make a case for their project, or lawmakers hear from stakeholders who want to appeal to the commissioner? What does that structure look like?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, there is an appeals process for grants that is outlined in our department regulations, and we can follow up with the committee with those regulations. But that would be the appeals process.
Very good. And just to reiterate something I asked about before, for those who aren't awarded grants, what kind of feedback will they get from the department? Will it just say, you know, we regret to inform you that your grant wasn't funded or your LOI wasn't accepted, or will it be something more substantive that lays out, you know, these two, you know, the numerical values and the portfolio review will sort of explain to them why they weren't awarded?
To the chair, we will provide them with as much information as we can. I think part of the challenge will be for some entities, I think it will be somewhat self-evident why it's not awarded. Not everything is a good fit. Not everyone is ready. You can look at an LOI and see that clearly. For others, they may have a really good idea, and it might be a very good project or something that they would like planning for. But with the number of letters of interest we've received, it's very competitive. And I think that there are a surprising proportion of very good ideas and very thorough letters of interest that we've seen so far. So for those entities that may have a really good project idea, but it just may not be some of the you know, given the competitive nature, it may not rise to the top. I would anticipate that they would want, and we will provide more information on that. And I think one of the things that we have been discussing, and it hasn't been fully built out yet, is how can we provide some feedback to organizations so they can think about taking that into consideration for the next round, which is coming up very quickly for round two. So again, this is not the only time that organizations will have a chance to submit their ideas.
Very good. Well, oh, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize. You just said something that I think is really interesting, that there potentially are significantly good ideas that we just can't use this pot of money to fund. Is the department working on a series of recommendations, maybe to the legislature in the next legislative cycle, to fund some good ideas that we may not be able to use these resources for, but we do have other dollars in the state government, and I'm all about implementing good ideas from the public?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, again, we're not through even kind of the first half of this process yet, although we're moving quickly. So I think at the end of this, one of the things that we would like to do is probably put on the advisory council agenda a review of how did the process go, what would we do better, what are some of the things that we would like to share out. I think that's a great idea to look at what are we not able to fund in this, but we think is a good idea. We also know that we are also talking with some of the other philanthropic groups in Alaska, because they may have funding available to support some of these projects if they're projects that we're not able to fund using Rural Health Transformation Program dollars. So it's an opportunity, I think, for us to really align on projects that have merit and think about how we can effectively use funding outside of the Rural Health Transformation Program too.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. I'll just add as a note to that, we have a resolution in our committee now from Representative Mina talking about the Rural Health Transformation Program, and it is directed towards the federal delegation, the federal government. And if there are very meritorious projects that you have that cannot fit this rubric, we can also ask the federal government to change the rubric in certain cases, so capital expenditures, for example. This was a program created in great haste by Congress last year, and then, you know, CMS is trying to implement it very quickly. I would anticipate some statutory changes in the coming years. And if there are places where you find very good projects that can't fit, I hope that there is some mechanism to tell our federal delegation or the legislature, so we can tell the federal delegation. Okay. No other further questions on that. We sort of derailed your testimony, Deputy Commissioner Ricci, but I don't know if you know where you could pick up or if there is further comments you'd like to make.
To the chair, I would just add, we have another advisory committee meeting that we are working to schedule on the morning of the 22nd. I think that was just noticed either last night or this morning. There will be more meeting minutes. We are also working to stand up something called Impact Series. And these are just intended to be a way for people providers, organizations in Alaska who are working on specific initiatives, right? We have six different initiatives to come together on a monthly basis via a Zoom call to kind of share those ideas and have different focus areas. So how do we continue to educate and bring people together across the state to keep discussing that? So we just had those, I think we just finished up the first month of those series, but we will be holding them every month with a break in July for summer, maybe a break in January. But that's just another way that we're trying to bring people together to raise awareness and to start to identify common themes in these different initiatives. I would also add that we are beginning regional planning meetings. Those were also part of the proposal, and the intent is to bring communities and regions together to really talk about the healthcare delivery system, what is working, where are the gaps, and are there agreed upon areas that they want to focus for the next few years, and to use that as a way to start thinking about future years funding for rural health transformation program projects, and to start again to identify those areas of alignment. I think in many communities, people already know where many of those areas or gaps are, but they don't always come together for a day to talk about that and to kind of have that shared understanding. So we are building that out right now, and I think the first series will start at the end of this month in the Kenai. So again, we will be reaching out as well to make sure that individuals know which of those meetings are happening in their regions or districts.
Very good. Well, thank you, Deputy Commissioner. We do have also Director Wood from the Office of Health Savings here. Director Wood, do you have anything you'd like to add today?
Thank you, Chair Dunbar. I did want to address Senator Tobin's question that came up earlier during Director Robb's presentation, if that would be helpful. I think it was around the physician's assistant compacting and what would happen if the state, you know, joined, but the compact hadn't been up and going. My understanding from the information that's been provided by CMS is that the requirement was that that we have legislation enacted to become a PA compact member, so i.e. that we've joined that compact. But I don't believe that a part of the requirement is whether or not the compact is actually up and running. So I think we have a little bit of leeway there, but I think CMS is willing to kind of work with states based off of what is the landscape when we kind of hit those 2027 and I think 2028 for some of those deadlines.
To the chair, to just clarify and add a little bit of context, CMS has said if there are issues that occur that are not outside, that are not within the control of the state, right, and are not anticipated, those are areas where they would work with the state to be successful. And so I would anticipate if we joined and we are just waiting for something that is outside of our control to occur, that would be the type of area where we could talk with CMS. But I just want to differentiate, that's different than the state not taking action on something that is within its controls.
Very good. Because she has been waiting this entire time, or has been online this entire time, I want to ask the Commissioner Hedberg, do you have anything you'd like to add today? We appreciate having you here at the committee.
For the record, this is Heidi Hedberg. Thank you. I appreciate this conversation. I think what you have heard from DC, Richie, and Betsy Wood is a lot of work is underway. I think the only thing I would add is that we did create positions, both policy positions and accountants, and I should clarify, not policy, but program staff. Those program positions are filled and they're going through training right now. And then we're in the middle of hiring our accountants so that we will be fully staffed to manage the Rural Health Transformation Program.
Very good. That's good news. Thank you, Commissioner Hedberg. Is there any final questions or discussion? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for being here, Deputy Commissioner and Director. And we will certainly be discussing both the CS 281 and RHTP more generally in the weeks to come. Thank you very much. All right, final announcements today, unless anyone has any discussion. I'm going to set an amendment deadline for HJR 32, Representative Mina's Rural Health Transformation Program resolution, for 5 p.m. on Monday, April 13th. I'm also setting a amendment deadline for SB 187, School Nutrition Meal Prohibit Food Dyes. Perhaps you want to add some more food dyes. For also 5 p.m. Monday, April 13th. The next meeting of Senate Health and Social Service Committee will be held on Tuesday, April 14th. We're going to take up both of those bills and look to the will of the committee. Actually, you know what? I'm sorry. I'm going to go back just for a second. We did notice public testimony on 281 today, and I'm not going to close it, but I'm going to pause here and briefly open it. So on 281, even though the CS has not been adopted, I'm opening public testimony. Is there anyone in the room today who would like to testify on SB 281? Not seeing anyone. Is there anyone online? I do not see anyone other than people from the administration online. So I'm going to hold open public testimony. I'm not closing it today. And we will have that bill back up before the committee another time. We will be hearing again Tuesday, April 14th. We're going to take up HGR 32 and SB 187 for public testimony and look to the will of the committee. We will also hold an initial hearing on SB 261, Unhoused Young Adults IDs and Birth Certificates, sponsored by Senator Gray Jackson. Thank you, everyone, for a productive hearing. It is currently 4:36, and this committee is adjourned.